Okay, so you were telling Leah about, I forget what his name was, that was how and how you ended up there with him on Christmas or Christmas Eve.
Oh, Lieutenant Siebel. He was my fire direction officer, and he was well known for his singing, among other things. But you know, it was one thing I'll never forget it. I can still see it today. And it was on Christmas Eve, 1968, and I can't remember the name of the fire support base, but I do remember sending the whole crew over to the Christmas show. They all left, and so it was just myself and Lieutenant Siebel. We stayed behind, and of course, it shouldn't have been a big deal because we had, you know, received word that there was a complete ceasefire. That supposedly the enemy had agreed to. So anyway, you know, it should have been a pretty quiet night. But anyway, after dark, it was late. It was probably, I don't know, it was late in the evening, probably 11 o'clock or whatever it was. And it was dark. And so Lieutenant Siebel left the fire direction center. And as he left, he walked out toward the gun parapets. And beyond that, there was illumination just, you know, floating down through the air. And it was just something very, you know, for a lack of a better term, I'll say spiritual. It was quiet. And there was just something beautiful about that. And especially when he climbed up and he was standing on a parapet and he was silhouetted also. And then behind him, these illumination rods were floating down real slow. And he started to sing Silent Night. And he had the most beautiful voice. And it was just something. It was just amazing to stand there and watch this and to hear. And as he sang Silent Night, and I remember he probably got through the first verse, and he was probably somewhere into the second verse, or toward the end of the second verse, or whatever. And all of a sudden, the radio started crackling, and it was a contact fire mission. So, you know, and I always remember that because it was so, just, you know, it was like it wasn't supposed to happen. We were supposed to be having a ceasefire. Of course, that didn't last, and so. And that contact fire mission came down, and that was the end of the song, and that was the end of the, it was the end of that beautiful, serene moment. I mean, it was like it was just, it was fantastic. It was beautiful, and I'll always remember that. I'll always that I can see it today. I can see him standing there. I can hear his voice, and he had a beautiful voice. And then all of a sudden, everything hit the fan. Contact fire mission. There was a group of infantry out somewhere. They got attacked, and I remember that. And so that was, and it was kind of the end of everything, you know. And for a long time, and I remember I used to think about that. And it was something really sad about all that, because it was kind of like something went unfinished, something so beautiful, and then to be interrupted that way. And so it was, you know, everybody had to get busy, and of course there was just him and I. And so I did the charts and the computing, and he got back. And by the time he got back to the fire direction center, the mission was pretty well ready to fire. And but it was one of those moments, and I remember thinking, you know, and I do, I remember putting that into perspective one day and realizing that even in the midst of war, there was in fact something beautiful. Beautiful beyond words. It's like I can't hardly put words to it. The way I felt. And, you know, in watching this unfold, it was one of the most beautiful sights I can remember.
Yeah, and the way you tell it, I can just, whenever you tell that, I can just see it because you describe it so good.
Yeah.
What's a, what again is a contact mission?
Contact?
What, that contact mission or whatever you
contact say? Fire mission, that means that they're actually in contact with the enemy.
Okay.
They're being fired upon.
Okay.
They're in a firefight.
Okay.
There are a number of different kinds of missions. Some are harassment and interdiction, which are just simply randomly selected coordinates that you fire on periodically throughout the night or some or whatever. It has nothing to do with contact, it's just done. And then there may be fire missions that would be for preparation for a landing zone, to clear a landing zone, things of that nature. But contact fire missions are the most urgent. They are, that means there is enemy contact, and they need to have it now.
Okay. And then that one time you were saying something about, there was one of the episodes there where you had something about there was ground something clearance or from somebody else somewhere and other kind of, you know, before you could fire?
Some missions, if they weren't contact fire missions, you had to... You had to get air clearance.
Oh, yeah, that was it.
And then you had to get ground clearance.
What'd that mean?
You had to contact higher-ups who took care of all this information, knew where the flight patterns were, knew where if people were located, and so that you would get ground clearance so that wherever you were firing would not be near friendlies.
Okay.
And that the air data could be posted, and that if there was no air traffic in that vicinity at that point, you could go ahead and fire, because the what we called air data in terms of height and direction of the rounds, that information would get posted, so anybody in the air would know that there was artillery being fired in that direction and that elevation. Now with contact fire missions, of course, it goes without saying, you know, it's kind of like, you don't need ground clearance because you already know who's mm-hmm. calling it in. They're giving that to you by virtue of calling it in.
Mm-hmm.
And then all you do then is you don't get permission for air. You just post the air data and fire.
Yeah.
And so there's a different protocol
mm-hmm.
for different kinds of missions. But the contact fire mission is the most important one. That's the one you don't mess around with that. You do it,
mm-hmm.
you know.
Mm-hmm.
And
let's see. So I'm trying to think of, okay, the story about Danny.
Oh, Danny?
Yeah.
Oh, Christ. That was at Fire Support Base Sioux, and that's when we were under ground attack at Fire Support Base Sioux, and we, I was working as the chief computer at that time. Lieutenant Siebel was my fire direction officer, and I was the chief computer, or section chief, if you want to say it, whatever. So I was in charge of the crew. And we had our fire direction center built out of ammo boxes, empty ammo boxes. And it's kind of interesting when I think about that, because we built it. It was just like a little house, kind of like a little shack, and with walls, and we had something over the roof and whatever. I think we had metal something over the roof. And it was kind of interesting, because what we were supposed to do, we were supposed to fill the ammo boxes with sand. We didn't. We left them hollow. We're lazy, I guess. But as it turns out, it saved our lives.
Huh.
at least it saved the lives of some anyway. Because we got, and the Fire Direction Center was located in a place on the fire support base where a fire direction center would, and I don't know why they did this. You would never put a fire direction center on the perimeter. That would just never happen. That's not a, that's a very vulnerable thing, you know, the fire direction, because that houses all the communications and all of the capabilities for firing missions. So usually the fire direction center was located in a rather more secure area, usually more toward the center. Mm-hmm. And but anyway, we were pretty right on the perimeter. The fence or whatever of the perimeter was probably no more than not even 100 meters away, which was unusual. We shouldn't have been there. We should have been located somewhere else. Well, anyway, that night we took an RPG, rocket-propelled grenade, came straight through our fire direction center. And the reason I say that, we were lucky the ammo boxes were empty, is because one of the things that happens is when an RPG, when it hits and it has resistance, it triggers something, and as soon as it comes out the other side, it explodes. Mm-hmm. Well, this one here went through a couple of walls first without exploding, and then it exploded. And so it kind of tore things up. And so we were on the perimeter, and it was not a safe place to be. Of course, if you're under ground attack, you don't know what's going to happen. So I sent the crew, I rounded them up, and of course it was all dark, all the lights were out, pretty much. And it was just, we, you know, had a little red flashlight with a red beam, and of course a little bit of lights from the radios were still on, but everything else was out. And so I rounded them up and I sent them to the center of the battery. And so to go on there and report to the first sergeant, and I said, you know, get out of here, you know, because this is not, it's not a good place to be. And so I stayed with me and Lieutenant Siebel. We stayed, and so as time went on, of course it's pitch dark out. Now the initial assault was with rocket propelled grenades and mortars. And they hit every machine gun position, they hit the fire direction center, and they hit the ammo dump. And that all took place immediately. And then the assault began. And so what I was trying to do is I was on the radio, and I called a number of different firing batteries for illumination to be fired for us so that we could light up the perimeter and see what's going on. And nobody would fire. Nobody would fire for us. Said they couldn't. They couldn't get clearance. And so I called headquarters. No, nobody can fire for you. Nobody could fire illumination for us. So I can remember thinking, well, I think we were thinking, well, you know, fuck it, you know. I know how to do this. So I went to the charts and I plotted for us to shoot illumination on top of us. Which, you know, not quite, you know. Mm-hmm. I call it self-illumination. We'll fire it for ourselves. So I computed that, you know, information, and I sent it down to the guns. And so just as that was happening, and I was sitting underneath this table, and I had the gun line, and there was this, all of a sudden there was a little human figure come into the doorway. Of course, Danny, he was a little guy, you know, he wasn't all that big. probably a little bit smaller than me. And I was sitting there, and I could hear something outside, and I didn't know what it was. And all of us, but I had my M16, I had it pointed at the door, full automatic with my finger on the trigger. And all of a sudden, this figure comes across. And you know, and now there was, in one part of me thought, well, when I heard that out there, that it was a sapper, and that, you know, and that was it. It was the enemy. Because we were right on the perimeter, and that figure come into the doorway, and I don't know why I didn't, but I didn't pull the trigger. I don't know why I didn't. And I sat there and I looked. I still had my finger on the trigger, fully automatic, pointing it at him, at this figure. And all of a sudden I heard someone say, D? I said, Danny? Does he get the fuck in here? You know, I said, Jesus Christ. Well, what happened was, in the initial RPG assault attack, he was knocked out. Well, of course, all this time he was laying in the back someplace in this other part of the center. We had kind of like two rooms. One was a kind of a sleeping quarters for guys. And he was knocked out. Of course, he had been knocked out all this time, and he just came to. And he had been cut above the eye. And so anyway, then we fired our illumination, self-illumination, which I got in trouble for, but I didn't care.
So why did you get in trouble? I forget.
Well, because I did what any common sense person would do. I did it. You know, and so what happened was, I cleared the you know, I looked for ground clearance, and of course when the illumination goes off, what happens is the illumination pops out the back of this canister, and the canister just keeps going. But when I computed where they were going to land, there was nobody there. There was nobody there, no one. Nowhere could I find anywhere that said there was anybody there. And as it turned out, the canisters were falling into a South Vietnamese base camp. But I thought, well, you know, nobody got hurt. And I said, what the hell, you know, so what? But we got our self-illumination. We ended up with two enemy killed. And that was the end of the assault. You know, everything just, that was it.
I wonder why.
Well, because we could see them.
Oh.
And see, the darkness was their, darkness was their friend.
Yeah.
But as soon as the light got on the subject and we could see everything, that was the end of it.
Mm-hmm.
Everything backed off, and that was the end of it.
Did Danny know he was almost killed?
I don't think so. I don't think I ever said anything to him. Nobody came very close. I've thought about that many times. Part of it is I used to just shudder to think that I could have pulled that trigger. I don't know why I didn't. But I remember also thinking, you know, that I felt bad because somehow when I rounded up everybody to send them to a safe place, I somehow didn't account for them. And that bothered me.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, you know, it was pretty hectic, I guess, and there was a lot of shit going on.
Mm-hmm.
And so, but you know, he ended up all right. He was from Wisconsin.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, he was from, if I remember right, Darling, Wisconsin.
So now, what, you were in what now, 199th?
Light Infantry Brigade.
And what, all the rest of it that follows?
Well, okay, so I was, that's the whole brigade.
Okay.
And my assignment was with C Battery, 2nd Battalion, 40th Artillery, which is one of like four or five batteries. I was with C Battery. That was my, in other words, I was assigned to C Battery, and at different times I was attached from C Battery to a infantry company as a part of a forward observer team.
Okay.
So the first my first attachment was with C Battery or C Company, 4th Battalion, 12th Infantry of the 199th. And that was Lieutenant Stanley was my forward observer then. And then my second attachment was just after TET, was with Bravo Company, 4th Battalion, 12th Infantry, where Jerome Wallace was my forward observer. And so with the C Company forward observer, you know, with that forward observer team, I was an RTO, radio telephone operator. And with my second attachment to Bravo Company, forward observer team, I was a recon sergeant. And, so it all kind of broke down that way.
Hmm. Now, you, Lieutenant Stanley, you were saying something about something he did foolish. What was it?
Well, he was kind of wild, you know. He was a hell of a nice guy. I liked him. And I was his RTO. Of course, I had the radio on my strapped to my back. And, of course, and so whenever he was talking on the radio, he had the mic here, you know, whatever. Then I had to go wherever he went. Of course, we're on VC Island, and we got under fire from the wood line, and automatic weapons fire from the wood line. Well, of course, right away he's going to call in the firemen, contact fire mission. But to my surprise, he grabs that goddamn mic. I don't know why, he takes off running toward the enemy. The fuckers are shooting at us,
yeah.
And he's running at them. Of course, I ain't got no choice because the radio is hooked to me, so I got to go with him. And I don't know why he did that, but that was crazy. But that's when we managed to, you know, chase him out of there. We got some rounds in there, artillery. And they spread. They vacated the area.
Mm-hmm.
And as we got there, and we were walking around, and my foot got hung up in the tall grass and the trees and this and that and whatever. And I remember standing there, you know, and I wouldn't move.
Mm-hmm.
And so I alerted everyone that it was possible I was hooked on with a tripwire.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you always had to be careful about that, a lot of booby traps.
Mm-hmm.
And that was kind of a scary moment. Because
mm-hmm.
I was just like, I didn't dare move. I wasn't sure when the firing or the shooting would start again. And but I alerted everyone. Of course, the people, you know, kind of backed off. And I'm standing there. Of course, and this one guy, he crawled over, and then he checked all around my foot and found whatever it was. As it turned out, it wasn't a tripwire,
mm-hmm.
but it, you know, could have been.
Yeah, yeah.
And so he unhooked it from me. And so.
Huh. What was BC Island anyway?
It was just the name of a place.
I mean, it wasn't really an island.
Probably, I don't know. I mean, at that, you know, I don't know if it was actually an island or not. But it was called the name of the place we flew into. We, you know, the landing zone, because
mm-hmm.
We went in by helicopter. The name they gave the place was VC Island. And I remember that place. And Stanley, of course. And Lieutenant Stanley, he was the guy, he was my fourth observer. We went on this one mission, and we ended up, and I don't know, we decided that we'd stay over. It started to get, you know, it was going to be dark, you know, or this was in the afternoon. So there was some materials around there and whatever, but it was a graveyard. So we decided that, you know, well, we'd stay there because supposedly graveyards were supposed to be somewhat safe because the Viet Cong wouldn't, you know, they respected graveyards. Mm-hmm. They wouldn't they wouldn't carry on with any, you know, fighting or something in a graveyard. So it kind of like, you know, well, graveyards should be safe. So we were going to stay there, but there were some holes dug. And so we got in, we dug this hole a little bit bigger. And there were some metal thing, sheets, something we laid over the top. Of course, this was the rainy season. And so we had sandbags on the top of that, just in case. And we had this little hole on this one end. So that's where we were going to spend the night, down in, underneath in this hole. So we get down in there that night, and it started to rain. Of course, when it rained over there, in the rainy season, it really rained. And so sometime during the night, the walls of the hole started caving in. Just started tumbling in like that. So Lieutenant Stanley takes his flashlight, he turns it on, there's all snakes, hundreds of them. Hundreds of snakes just rolling in on us.
Oh, yikes.
And of course they were just, oh my God, it was just, I can't even describe it. They were just, you know, here was a snake colony, I guess, or a nest or whatever. They were just tumbling out of the wall, just all over us, you know, and all crises. At least we were scrambling out of there. And so we left a bunch of shit there.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, we just got the hell out of there. We just said, well, you can have it, you know. So we slept in the rain that night. We just laid on the ground.
Yeah.
The next morning, so we were still working with the South Vietnamese Rangers. So they came over and they wanted to know what was going on. So we told them, of course, and they laughed. You know. So they went down in there and got all our stuff.
Oh, they do, they.
Yeah.
Were the snakes gone then?
I don't know. We never looked back. We never went back in there. The only time I ever saw him pissed off was he reached into his ammo pouch and there was a big centipede in there. And he just hated those things. I mean, they were huge. They were like centipedes were like this.
Oh, yikes.
They were about that wide.
Yeah.
That long. They were huge. And, you know, and if they bit your ass, I mean, they would hurt. And he was really pissed because he thought somebody had done that as a trick.
Yeah.
I don't think they did, but that was the first time I ever really saw him pissed off.
Yeah.
And he was a big guy. He said if he could have got a hold of somebody who did that, he would have fucking killed him.
Yeah.
And he was really pissed, but he was a good guy. But I liked him. So then when he rotated out of the field, eventually, and then he became, of course, I had already been pulled out because of my ankles and my, you know, fungus or jungle rot, whatever.
And when was that then?
That must have been, he must have rotated out of the field probably around November, and probably November, sometime not long after I was pulled out.
67?
Yeah. Okay. And so then he became my fire direction officer, which I was really glad because I liked him. He was a good guy. We got along real good. He was always good to me. And So, so anyway, yeah.
You want to take a break?
Yeah.
I'll see if I can. Okay, all right. Well, let's see. I always liked the Sebastian Cabot little story.
Sebastian Cabot. Now, he's a, you know, he's an interesting character, of course. You know, we didn't realize how all this was going to come down, and of course he was a well-known person. I mean, everybody knew who he was, and he happened to be one of the celebrities that was visiting the troops in South Vietnam, and so he went with us on this one. On this one liftoff, and so of course we airlifted into a fire support base location where we had then set up artillery. And so that night there was a big show. If I remember right, it was probably Thanksgiving or something like that. And it was a big deal because, you know, all the big shots and whatever, security was real high, and all the big shots got to go to this big show at this great big tent. And of course at the tent and where the show was actually taking place, Sebastian Cabot was there to say hello. And that was about it. Because the important people that were there were we referred them to as donut dollies. They were Red Cross people. They worked for the Red Cross and they volunteered for the Red Cross and whatever. So they became donut dollies. But aside from that, they had the professional tour, you know, of women who did their thing. I mean, you know, sang their songs and undressed their dress and you name it. I mean, they were having a good time. Of course, that's where all the big shots went. And so Sebastian Cabot said hello and goodbye to all those people there. And so he shows up at our battery location for his big contribution to the show, which would ceremoniously take place in the morning as he approached a gun, if I remember right, it was base piece, gun number 3, and it was loaded. And so the ceremonious thing for him was to pull the lanyard, fire the gun, kaboom. So everybody could say, Sebastian Cabot fired this gun. Mm-hmm. People had pictures of it. Well, it was fun, you know. But it was always kind of funny because what our expectations was, you know, with regard to a party or whatever, or a good time, it didn't work out that way. Sebastian Cannon.
So was Nancy Sinatra over in that bunch that night? Or?
She most certainly was.
Okay.
And I didn't see her pull no lanyard. She may have pulled one somewhere, but.
And you didn't get to see her sing "These Boots Are Made for Walking"?
Yeah. Yeah. So. But then, yeah, that was the way it always went.
So, I mean, did you ever get to really see a show? I mean, did anybody ever do a show?
Yeah. You know, the shows were usually pretty well orchestrated. They were. You know, security was really important.
Mm-hmm.
So when the shows were done, and everything about them, it usually became a security thing. So a lot of times people who otherwise would probably have had time and could have seen the show didn't see the show because they were on guard duty someplace,
mm-hmm.
protecting all the people who were watching the show.
Mm.
So it was kind of an odd thing, but the shows did take place, a lot of times they were set aside for the elite. Not everybody got to see the shows.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of times what would happen is, like in our unit, if there was an opportunity, then I would just let everybody go.
Mm-hmm.
And that way nobody got left out. Everybody was pretty much on their own,
mm-hmm.
but I just let everybody go. So.
And then you had talked about the donut dollies that they were nice.
Yeah. They were very nice people. I mean, they were genuinely nice to all of us.
Mhm. So did they do things besides donuts?
Huh?
Did they do things besides donuts then?
There were rumors.
No, I don't mean like that.
But only if you were an officer and a gentleman. Yes, they did. They helped. They helped a lot of guys with. You know, maybe somebody wanted to send home a package, you know. Maybe somebody wanted to write a long letter. Or maybe this guy was wounded and he couldn't, you know, write at the time. So, I mean, they did a lot of things that were just simply nice things to do.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's what they did. So they were nice enough.
But they did serve donuts too?
Oh yeah. Yeah, they had donuts. That's where they got their donut dollies. Identification.
Where did they serve them?
Huh?
Where did they serve them?
Oh, wherever in the battery area. Chow line. No. I don't know where they got them. Some cook someplace, probably in the back. Probably cooked them all up. I don't know.
Did you say you always made friends with the cooks?
Oh, yeah.
And somebody finagled something sometime for you? Or they finagled something?
Oh,
or
yeah.
Reminded me of Radar and some of those guys, how they finagled stuff.
Yeah, I always made it a point to try to, when I had the opportunity, was to put in a plug, have a little extra beefed up relationship with the cook. At least the head cook. Always paid off. Always good to know the cook. Because if you're hungry, there's always going to be food for you. They'd always set it aside.
Mm-hmm.
As one cook used to set aside every night. Nobody else could find it, but I could. But every night there would be fresh cucumbers, tomatoes, fresh baked bread, and a knife, and salt and pepper.
Hmm.
And that was my sandwich. No. Cucumber sandwich with tomato. It was good. But that's what you got for being a friend. Tell them what you wanted.
And then there was something you talked about in the canned stuff that you got that was good. The sea rations or whatever they were. Something that was good in those that I wouldn't have thought.
Oh yeah, there was the favorites. Then there were the not so favorites. Ham and lima beans were the worst. Nobody wanted them. But then there were they were the magical ones. They were the pound cake.
Oh.
Was like, if you happened upon a pound cake, that was like gold. And then there was the spaghetti and meatballs. And then the next highest was the Frank and beans. Yeah, they were good. Then we came upon this thing, LERP rations. They were for long-range reconnaissance. And of course, they didn't involve any tin cans. The noise element. So they had bags, and the bags would, you'd open the bags and pour hot water and mix it up. It was dry food, it was dry, freeze-dried.
Mm-hmm.
And they had some really good meals.
So that was kind of like the predecessor of the MREs.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, you gotta remember, you know, a lot of what we were eating, like the sea rations, they were from, 1944. They were old.
Oh boy.
But anyway, there was a lot of that.
When you were talking about those stars on that Vietnam sticker there and what they mean. Five, the silver one is five. Five. Five what?
Each, sometimes it's referred to in different ways. Many times now you've heard it referred to as campaign ribbon.
Mm-hmm.
That's the Vietnam service ribbon. And that the stars represent campaigns.
Mm-hmm.
And, prior to that, at one point, they were referred to, those stars, each were referred to as a major enemy offensive.
Mm-hmm.
So when it comes to that representation, each a silver star represents five, and each single star represents a single star until it gets to five, and then it's five, and the silver represents five. And so they're represented that way.
Do you remember what they were, the eight?
Pretty much.
Okay.
I can't recite them. I used to remember. But I was wounded in the mini Tet offensive. That's one description.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise known as the May offensive.
Mm-hmm.
Against Saigon. There's different names and whatever. But
is Tet considered an offensive?
Yeah.
Well, wasn't that actually like a defensive?
It was actually a holiday.
No, but I mean the whole thing, wasn't the offensive side the North Vietnamese? Wasn't it their offense, and like, weren't we playing defense?
Pretty good, that's a good question. It probably is true. It probably is.
But it counts as an offensive on those stars there.
Yeah.
Okay.
Or a campaign.
Campaign.
See, they kind of simplify things after a while.
Campaign, okay. Yeah.
What's you? So I participated in eight. And I think if I remember right, there was a total of 17.
Altogether? In the whole, whatever.
Vietnam.
10 years, 15 years, whatever it was.
Yeah.
15 total.
Something like that.
Yeah. Huh. So you're over half. Well, weren't you lucky?
Yeah. Hmm. Well, anyway. So that's kind of where all that's at.
Is that enough for tonight?
I think so.
Okay.
That was fun.